You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's show...
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
Donald Trump there responding to a violent far-right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia at the weekend. His statements have been sharply criticised across the political spectrum for failing to criticise white supremacists directly. We take a closer look at the politics and symbolism behind the violence. My guests, Carol Walker and Daniela Peled, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the possibility of Australia's deputy PM becoming the next victim of the country's law against dual nationals holding office, and here, the UK government finally setting out detailed plans for Brexit. All that, plus London's highly controversial Garden Bridge project, becomes the latest edition on the scrap heap of history. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed political commentator and former BBC political correspondent Carol Walker and Daniela Peled, managing editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. A warm welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Let's start in the US, where over the weekend violence erupted in Charlottesville, Virginia, when a white nationalist attending a rally clashed with counter-protesters. One woman was killed when a car drove into a group of counter-protesters, with many others injured. President Donald Trump condemned the violence, but he was heavily criticised for failing to single out the white nationalists who'd initiated it. The rally, called Unite the Right, was ostensibly against the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, but with many of the protesters chanting slogans and carrying banners that explicitly evoked Nazi imagery, the clash was clearly about rather more than that. Daniela Peled, the main protest was preceded by a march on Friday in which protesters chanted white supremacist slogans and other things. They were carrying torches and various sort of, symbols of the far right movement. This was largely organised online. And it's interesting because you have this very regressive racist imagery and the sort of fleet-footedness of modern online organisation. Is this a sort of a new front, before we get into the detail of what then came to pass, with tackling the way that far-right groups organise and manifest themselves?
Well, the internet is a new frontier for all kinds of radicalisation. And I think the key here is the issue of freedom of speech. And that's another arena where the internet is proving quite problematic. A lot of monitoring and policing of far-right and Islamist and far-left, what have you, sites and chatter. It takes up an enormous amount of resources. I'm not sure how useful it is. And we really haven't worked out yet what counts as incitement to racial hatred or violence in an online context. If you were to prosecute everyone that sent offensive tweets, or tweets indeed that incited violence, you know, the law enforcement bodies wouldn't be doing anything else.
Mm. And Carol, what do you make on that point? Because ultimately, I guess this is one of these things about this red line between free speech and its entitlements and hate speech and its risks, and where that line is drawn. I mean, one of the problems, presumably, is that wherever you go, there are different nuances. There's different codifications as to what free speech means. And the US is complicated in that respect anyway. Is it unhelpful to look at what passes elsewhere when we reflect on the US, or I guess necessarily need to analyse each of these things on their own merits?
I think clearly it's very difficult, because the internet by its very nature is this global phenomenon, but statements which may be acceptable in one part of the world will cause huge offence in others. I think what's interesting in this case is that you have seen a demonstration that brought together some who might just be pretty much on the right of society, but fairly acceptable, but along with some Ku Klux Klan. There were people there wearing white hoods. There were people there with Nazi insignia. And I think that is why there's been so much pressure on Donald Trump to come out and condemn not just the violence in general terms, but specifically the white supremacists who were at the centre of the original demonstration. And it's fascinating to see that just as we were coming on air, after increasing pressure on him, Donald Trump has come out and specifically said that he condemns the evil of what he called criminals and thugs, including the KKK. But in a sense, that was almost too late. It only came after many in his own party, in his own Republican Party, had said, look, we've got to do more to distance ourselves from this group of people, because clearly many of them were carrying out activities, chanting slogans that were pretty much beyond the pale, I think, for most right-thinking people.
Daniel, why would... I mean, it's hard to second-guess Trump. We've done it, and it's a risk every time. But why did he wait so long to explicitly denounce, you know, some of these white supremacist groups? And today he said, you know, there is no place for bigotry. And yet he did. He was strangely, you know, mealy-mouthed in his initial pronouncements. I mean, that's an easy statement to get right, even for someone like Donald Trump,
well,
isn't it?
I think not strangely at all. I think it seems quite in character from what we've come to expect from him. And the his very, very tardy denunciation of the KKK, really, he might as well not have bothered, because it's really it's as if he was giving a nod and a wink, saying, well, all right, I have to do this and say, make lip service. I mean, we could also make the argument, it's impossible to second guess, you could also make the argument that it was just clumsy wording from his point of view, and one that the administration is just sort of incapable of getting a proper message out. Now, it really stands in contrast to his predecessor, who, although not, I wouldn't say one of the best presidents in American history, had a real talent for this kind of coming up with the right kind of oratory at these sorts of moments. I mean, I remember that in 2015, after the Charleston shootings, and he gave a thundering speech in church. He sang Amazing Grace. And it's just words and it's just image. But sometimes a nation and sometimes people really need that kind of unity. And that was the kind of leadership he could show. Now, in contrast, this is one of the most sort of contrasting points so far. And it's frightening.
And Carol, on that point about unity or lack of in the US, particularly if we look to, you know, conservatism in the States, and people talk about the alt-right and other labels like that, I wonder what you think. I mean, are those labels increasingly unhelpful? Is that just a weird subculture within the right wing of the US? Is the real risk with the alt-right, or whatever you want to call it, and its particularly shouty advocates, that they begin to legitimise what are essentially just racist, they're racist nationalist views?
Well, I think what is clear here is that some of those who were involved in this demonstrations have actually said that they were inspired by Donald Trump's campaign slogans about taking our country back. They, many of them, praised his initial reaction, which was to condemn the violence on both sides, as though there was some equivalence between people walking through the streets with Ku Klux Klan hoods and those that turned out to say, listen, let's stop these racist chants, when the violence was perpetrated by someone who drove a car into those who were opposing the right-wing march, and a woman was killed in that. That is an attack that had similarities to some of the terrorist attacks that we've seen in places like here in the UK, yet Donald Trump appeared until just a few minutes ago to be drawing an equivalence between both sides. And I think why it is so significant that it took him so long to condemn those on the right is that many of them clearly do feel emboldened by Donald Trump. They are trying to claim his rhetoric to justify what they stand for. And I think under those circumstances, the danger is that those divisions that there are in society are likely to be further inflamed, because if you've got one side ramping up the pressure, saying that they feel entitled to go out on the streets with some of these chants which are blatantly racist, then that is not a recipe for harmony. And I think, as Daniela was saying, the failure of Donald Trump to try to calm the situation immediately afterwards clearly increases that risk that those tensions will increase, not just in Charlottesville, but in other parts of the United States where we've already seen other demonstrations from people who are outraged at what's been happening in Charlottesville.
And Daniela, just on Trump and what's personally, politically expedient for him, you know, we've seen that amongst these sort of alt-right figures, there is a great enthusiasm for him, or there certainly was when he first came into office. Is there another problem here, which is that I mentioned their rhetoric, they make a lot of noise, they can shape the political landscape very much in a negative way, but does it make them harder for someone like Trump to condemn? Because he's thinking, look, these are people who are vocal in their support for me. They're also vocal in loads of other, even more reprehensible ways, but it's a risk if he condemns them explicitly.
Well, absolutely. I mean, his support isn't exactly increasing on the liberal left side of
American politics.
But does
it mean he increasingly needs to play, to pander to precisely these even more sort of worrying and dangerous right-wing
elements?
Well,
I think it's got a dynamic of its own, which is, until very recently, the KKK, Nazism, was really outside the political, outside the pale. I mean, unequivocally. You could raise questions about immigrants and Muslims and Jews and really be quite racist in your rhetoric, but that would, that, you know, go thus far and no further. And that's being blurred a little bit by this alliance between the alt-right, although it slightly sticks in my craw to even use that term anymore. But it's right, there are people who are not fully signed up members of the far right movement, and these groups with an immense amount of historical baggage.
It's just interesting to see that what Donald Trump has finally said: racism is evil, those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis and white supremacists are repugnant to everything Americans hold dear. Now, I think those words, if he'd spoken them in the immediate aftermath of this attack, of this violence in Charlottesville, I think people would have felt that that was really a quite an extraordinary move by Donald Trump, that it would perhaps reassure many people who felt that he was far too close to some of these alt-right groups, which Daniela was talking about.
He might even have sounded presidential for a moment.
He just might, but the fact that it has seemed to have been dragged out of him, I think just makes those words simply too late to have any kind of impact. I think people will look at it as words that were scripted in the White House by a team that realised that even many of those Republicans who are so important to Donald Trump were pressurizing him to say these sorts of statements. So the fact that it was dragged out of him, I think, means that it simply will not have the impact that it could have had if he'd simply said it as though it was something that he genuinely believed.
But he doesn't often speak about things he genuinely believes in. We still don't know if there are any. To Australia now, where the country's Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, is under threat. Having broken the law, his crime was simply being a dual national of Australia and New Zealand. The law isn't against New Zealanders, though he perhaps would be forgiven for making that assumption. It's against any dual national holding office, and it is continuing to cause havoc. Two senators resigned last month when they were outed as dual nationals. Another two are awaiting a decision on their eligibility from the High Court. Daniela, we've spoken often about people, where they're from, how important or unimportant it is with the labels we attach. Can there be any arguments in favour of a law like this in a country like Australia in a time like now?
I think in Australia it's quite hard to make this argument, since essentially most people are from somewhere else. I can see the point of arguing for it in other contexts. I mean, I think more than half of the countries in this world allow dual nationality. There's something to be said that it might be problematic if you are a citizen of two countries, and then there might be a conflict of interest. But it's really just a matter of perception. I mean, in the States, for instance, it's not illegal to be have dual nationality and hold public office, but then there's no need to declare it either, which leads to all kinds of sort of rumours and misinformation about it. I'm sure we remember that Bernie Sanders was accused of being having dual citizenship. Why are you an Israeli citizen? He was asked. I mean, that's happened to me on more than one occasion as well. People assume if you're Jewish, you must be a citizen of Israel. And that plays into all kinds of very unfortunate prejudices. So I think it is, it's an issue of belonging. It's an issue of really having the question, are you a fifth columnist and are you truly loyal to your country? But in terms of the current Australian political landscape, it seems really rather strange.
And Carol, on that point, it's particularly galling, I imagine, for some of these people, given that they're representing the citizens of Australia, a country, as Daniela said, built on and by and for migrants in so many respects. Plus, in some of these examples, I believe some of these senators or ministers were unaware they even had one of them. His mother had applied for it out of a sort of romantic notion about the old country. So how biased can you be if you don't even know you're a citizen of another country?
This seems to be utterly bizarre in a nation that is built on immigrants, that there now seems to be this sort of witch hunt going on. I mean, Barnaby Joyce is somebody who's been a pretty high-profile politician for many years, and somehow somebody has dug up this fact that he might unwittingly be dual nationality and a New Zealander. And we've seen some extraordinary things. So Tony Abbott, another former prime minister, apparently tweeted that he had renounced his UK citizenship in 1993 and actually tweeted the document to prove that he had done so. This is a country where even today, 26% of Australian citizens are born overseas. And it just seems extraordinary that as a politician, you're now going to be scrabbling around to just make sure that somewhere in your history you didn't unwittingly have some part of another country's citizenship there in your family. It seems extraordinary. I don't really understand why it's seen as such a crime there. And you would think, and apparently, if he is forced to stand down, this could actually bring down the whole Australian government. So the consequences could be quite serious for Australian politics. And goodness me, what's going to happen in that Australian election campaign? Is citizenship going to be one of the key issues the potential members of the Australian Parliament go to the polls?
And Daniela, on that point, you know, this could bring down a government in effect. And it isn't exactly the kind of narrative that one would perhaps associate with what is ostensibly a progressive democracy. Now, I know Australia has its problems, certainly on various aspects of migration and immigration policy. It's not necessarily as progressive as perhaps it could or should be. Is there a danger here, though, that we draw this into these other discussions? We're talking about the rise of nationalism and racists, you know. Is there a broader problem with this sort of identity politics? And everywhere we look, we seem to be having this chat all across Europe. We'll come on to talk about Brexit in a moment here in the UK. Is there an unsavoury, I don't know, note in the air in many places where you would have liked to have thought that we were kind of beyond asking these kind of questions?
Absolutely. And I think this is the reason why this has got so much traction in the Australian media. I think it does play to this current atmosphere of the feeling amongst some Australians that they're under attack of issues of migration and issues of their culture and issues of borders. Well, not just Australia, that plays very strongly across the world. Now, it would be a serious story if, for instance, we discovered that Donald Trump had dual Russian citizenship, for instance. But beyond that,
I'm not ruling anything out at this stage.
There was even that question that was raised by our foreign secretary about the Kenyan-born former President Barack Obama.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is just basically a kind of virtue signalling way of saying, does this person belong? Is he really, he or she really one of us?
But it's so, you know, half of, another figure to back up the one Carol's, half of Australians, half of them have a parent born outside of Australia. Yeah. Every other person in Australia. I mean, it's
extraordinary. And yet migration is still a massive issue. This doesn't, I mean, this is about feelings and perceptions, not really about logic when it comes down to it. And this feeling and perception that politicians, well, they need to be whiter than white or they need to be held accountable. But this idea that, well, you know, Boris Johnson is an American citizen as well, as I understand it, that's not really on the list of things that people can attack him for in the UK, where I think we are, as with many things, a little bit more sensible.
Can we ship Boris back to the States then? I don't know. He'd find a bedfellow.
I think we need a referendum.
Okay. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, Carol Walker and Daniela Pellard. Up next, the UK government's long-awaited Brexit plans, or are they? And the death of London's Garden Bridge.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing Bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me around the table in Studio One, Carol Walker and Daniela Peled. Now, yesterday, Liam Fox, Britain's International Trade Secretary, and Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, published a joint statement in the Sunday Telegraph newspaper confirming that the UK will not remain in the customs union during any transitional period after the country leaves the EU. It was meant, one imagines, as a display of unity from a cabinet that's been portrayed as anything but on its approach to Brexit. What's more, Theresa May's government is set to begin releasing more detailed plans for its post-Brexit relationship with the EU this week. Carol Walker, after a year, is the UK getting its act together on Brexit?
Well, unfortunately, I think that we're still a very long way off it. I think for all those people who a year ago voted to leave the European Union, the prospect that actually the government has now got a clear plan, not quite. I think this joint article yesterday was a rather contrived attempt to try to show that the British cabinet is united around its vision of Brexit when we know that there are really deep divisions. All they said in this article is, look, we're going to leave the single market, we're going to leave the customs union, and there's going to be a transition period afterwards. Well, that's not so very different from what Theresa May said right back at the beginning of the year. And it still begs the question, how long is the transition period going to be? And what exactly is the UK going to transition to? Now, interestingly enough, this week, we are at last, we're told, going to be getting some detailed policy papers. So tomorrow, we're going to hear some of the customs plans, though it's difficult to see how accurate and detailed those can be when Britain is so far off a deal with the European Union on what the future trading relationship is going to be. And then on Wednesday, a document about what's going to happen to the Irish border, because, of course, once Britain has left the EU, Northern Ireland will be out of the European Union. The Republic of Ireland would remain a member of it. The plan, we're told, is an Ireland-UK free trade zone, which would be an interesting proposal with all kinds of high-tech gizmos to try to check goods as they cross over the border. And I think people would be delighted if we begin to see at least a concrete plan like that. But I think the difficulty is that there is so much still to be negotiated in the months ahead, and Britain is still very long way off making the sort of progress it needs if it's going to hit those deadlines.
Well, and Daniela, I thought it was an interesting point. Liam Fox and Philip Hammond in this piece reiterated this notion that the Brexit vote was a vote for change, very decisively from the British people. It was a vote for change of sorts, but it surely wasn't a vote for these sorts of changes. And as Carol describes there, so much uncertainty remains. This is only papering over the cracks. It's not even going to convince the public that there's any unity in the cabinet, is it?
Well, I remain very, very, very unconvinced. I mean, the whole purpose of this latest exercise, as in, I think the whole purpose of the referendum in the first place was to try and resolve this eternal issue of a lack of agreement in the Conservative Party over Europe. And didn't actually change anything or improve anything. I think it's, well, I would like to hear some answers, some concrete ideas, but I think this is another, you know, another exercise to show us that even though Theresa May is on holiday, they are actually doing something. Well, the position papers will be interesting. Certainly, the Northern Ireland border, if there's some creative proposals for that, I think that will go some way towards reassuring people that we're heading not in the right direction, but in some direction. As for the rest of it, I'm as unconvinced as ever, unsurprisingly. The No, I mean, there isn't. I'm really trying to be fair. I'm trying to think of one bit of the narrative that I am convinced by. But from the joint article onwards, there's just nothing there for me.
And Carol, just on that point about how bleak the future may not be, a seasoned watcher, of course, of Westminster, as you are, how lame a lame duck is May? Obviously, she's sort of weakened her own hand with this election, which all backfired. I don't know. Is there... Do you look to history, other examples? Is she going to weather this? I mean, she's got her work cut out, right?
Well, she's in a very difficult situation. She's just back from her holiday. We are expecting in the next week or two her to make a big speech on Europe, on Brexit, saying where the government has got to, setting out an updated vision of what that is going to mean for the country. But yes, she has got her work cut out. One suggestion is that at her party conference in the autumn, she's going to apologise to her party for having called an election that she didn't need to call and throwing away a perfectly decent working majority and putting herself in a situation now where the government has had to junk many of its original plans, where it's going to struggle, for example, to get through this repeal bill, which is going to move EU legislation into British law. But although she is in a difficult position, she is helped, I think, by the fact that no one in her party at the moment wants to remove her because they fear that to do so would bring about another general election and they could lose that outright and you could see a Labour government. I think that helps her enormously. I think it's also worth thinking back to John Major's time in power in coming up to the 1992 election. He had limped through that parliament. Eventually, his majority was completely eroded. He was also battling his party over Europe, trying to get through the Maastricht Treaty. That was a treaty which put more power into the hands of Brussels. He was fighting people who would now be described as Brexiteers. There were knife-edge votes. He lost a knife-edge vote. He faced a vote of no confidence. He was seen as rather boring and robotic. But the party then rallied round him. He survived the no-confidence vote and won an election which nobody said he would win. So I think before we write off Theresa May, I think it is worth looking into history to say that even when it looks as though she has absolutely no chance of surviving, she could limp on for quite some time.
And I think in that 92 election, it was the most votes any single party ever received at a general election or something like that. It was an extraordinary turnaround in 92.
So. It certainly defied all the expectations and all the polls.
Finally, on today's programme, troubled waters at Westminster, if you'll go with me on this. Plans for a bridge covered in trees over London's River Thames have been abandoned after failing to win the backing of the city's mayor, Sadiq Khan. The €220 million project was criticised from the outset as a waste of public money, a vanity project of Khan's predecessor, Boris Johnson, him again, an evaluation that Khan now seems to have agreed with, though it did take him a while. Over €40 million of public money have already been spent on the project. The blame game, which had already begun, continues. Daniela, is this a political football that's being kicked around? And actually, we should be glad that it's now in the long grass. Does it just demonstrate how many disastrous, costly white elephant cities still almost saddle themselves with in the name of personal political vanity? Where to start?
Well, it is. I mean, I wanted to like the Garden Bridge. I wanted to like the idea of this new thing across the Thames. I mean, the experience of crossing the Thames as somebody, you know, as a Londoner born and bred, still something really quite magical for me. And the idea that it was going to be designed by a top UK designer, it was going to be London's answer to the High Line. We were actually going to build something new and exciting and cool. But then it really did not stand up to scrutiny. The idea of this as a sort of basically what would end up, I'm sure, as just a corporate venue of no actual use to the residents of London. Mm. I mean, I frankly think they should have kept that that bridge outside, the wobbly bridge. They should just kept that wobbly, and that would have said so much more about the British national character than any kind of garden bridge. Yeah, so there's also been some quite good journalism into this and really unpicking where the funding and all the different forces are at play here. I think we have to regretfully say, yes, this was a vanity project. Everyone was making political capital out of it. It shouldn't actually have got as far as it did.
And Carol, there's the rub, isn't it? This is a demonstration of what happens when there's a divorce between what's in the true public interest and these sort of vainglorious projects, which understandably, but not really, it's not acceptable that our politicians pursue, because they want to have, you know, the great moment, the great ribbon cutting thing with the big oversized scissors and all the rest of it.
Yeah, this was a political casualty. This was Boris Johnson's, well, his critics called it from the outset, a vanity project. Like Daniela, I initially liked this idea that it was going to have 270 trees on it on a bridge over the Thames. But the trouble is, it was going to be closed at night. It was going to be closed for special events. You weren't going to be allowed to kick a football in it. You just wonder how much anyone who actually lives in the area would have benefited from it. And I think that was one of its problems from the start. The local people were not taken on board. Londoners were going to pay a substantial sums for this. As you mentioned, 40 million has already been spent. It was going to be 70 million. And they failed to leverage in the private money. And that, I think, is because it was never seen as a project that was going to benefit the area. There's lots of other bridges around there already.
Exactly. So take your pick from those. Carol Walker and Daniela Pellett, thank you both for joining us on Midori House. Thanks to the team behind the glass. Tune in at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.